Today's sermon is actually taken from a quote from C.S. Lewis. A long time ago, C.S. Lewis said these words, "Pain insists on being attended to. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pain. It is his megaphone to rouse a dead world." God's megaphone has been on. God has been speaking to Job, in Job. And yet, all through the book of Job, Job has been crying out, "God, would you please say something? I'm not getting the memo. I'm not getting reception in this part of the city. I'm in a dead zone. I can't get any cell reception, and I can't hear a word from you." And yet, God had been speaking to Job. And he had been speaking to him in his pain. Not around it, not in spite of it, but in the very midst of it. God's megaphone had been on. But now, in chapter 38, exactly what Job wanted happens. God speaks, and God breaks the silence. We need to kind of get a little picture of how Job's doing. What we kind of need to do is we need to reach through the text. We need to take our hand, we need to put it on Job's wrist, and we need to feel for his pulse. We need to check his blood pressure. We need to see how the man is doing, because Job has been through a lot. We read at the beginning that Job did not sin with his lips, that Job was a blameless man. He was upright. And we found out throughout the text of the book of Job that Job was not suffering because of some sin in his closet that he was hiding. But Job had started to sink into the same tendencies that all of us would. In our hurt, in our struggles, in our pain, we begin to think that we can do a better job than God. And that's exactly what happens. Let's take a look at a couple of texts, just a couple. Look back at chapter 7. Job chapter 7, verse 10. Actually, I'm going to start in verse 7. "Remember that my life is a breath. My eye will never see again anything good. The eye of him who sees me will behold me no more. While your eyes are on me, I shall be gone. As the cloud fades and vanishes, so he who goes down to Sheol does not come up. He returns no more to his house, nor does his place know him." Job is feeling at the very pit of despair. Turn over to chapter 10, verse 3. He is now speaking towards God. And here's what he says. "Does it seem good to you to oppress?" He is saying that God is oppressing him. "To despise the work of your hand." So he's speaking to God and saying, "God, so you're really despising your created work," speaking of himself, "and favor the designs of the wicked." Job is feeling on the outs with God, and he's feeling that God has not only dropped the ball, but dropped him. Verse 4, "Have you eyes of flesh? Do you see as man sees? Are your days as the days of man? Are your years as a man's years? That you seek out my iniquity and search for my sin, although you know that I am not guilty." Job is expressing a lot of, I almost hate to say it to this extent, but I almost have to go along with what John Calvin is saying, is that no one is as innocent as Job claims to be. Here he's dealing with a lot of arrogance. He's not overwhelmed by it. He's not speaking against God, but he's misinformed. He's struggling in his heart with what's going on in his life. Chapter 12, verse 22, he accuses God of what he calls bringing deep darkness to light. It seems as though what he's saying is that God has allowed evil into this world, and he's doing it for kicks and giggles. In chapter 9, verses 5 and 6, he's saying that in a place of order, God, you have brought disorder. Now, before you get too hot and bothered by this, how many of us would be struggling with the same things? We pray, we ask God for the removal of this pain, of this hurt. We've done nothing, or so we think, to bring this on to ourselves, and yet it just doesn't go away. The hurt remains. And so, almost imperceptibly, Job slips into the place of King Alfonso X of Spain, who in the 13th century, by the way, he was nicknamed Alfonso the Learned. Listen to what he says. "Had I been present at the creation, I would have given some useful hints for the better ordering of the universe." Well, I'm sure God sat back and said, "Wow, I wish I had him around. If I were running this place, if I could make the decisions, if I were the one in charge, I could really make a difference." Maybe we don't say it like that. Maybe we're praying for something. Maybe we're praying for something and have been praying for something for a long time. And instead of saying, "If I were the one in charge, I'd make a difference," maybe instead we start thinking, "God, if you were more like this, you would do a better job at running this universe. You would do a better job at running my life." Oh no, we would never say that out in public. We'd never say that at a church testimony meeting. But we feel it. It was A.W. Tozer who said, "The mistake we have made all down through history is thinking that we know better than God. The mistake we have made all down through history is in thinking that we know better than God." Finally, God speaks. Chapter 38, verse 1. "And the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said," in a storm, he answers Job. I think he answered Job in the midst of Job's storm. And that's often when he speaks to us. He speaks to us in the midst of our storm. He did that with Ezekiel. In the midst of the storm, Ezekiel saw the throne covered with the rainbow. He spoke to Noah at the end of the storm. Here he speaks in the very midst of the storm. While the pain is still on, everything is still fresh. God speaks. "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" Wouldn't you love to have that verse right on the tip of your tongue when you're at a board meeting or when you're interviewing someone? You just want to say this back to them. "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" Job, you are saying things without really understanding what you're saying. That's exactly what Elihu said about Job. And now God says the same thing. So Job was saying things that he didn't fully understand. Verse 3, "Dress for action like a man." You want me to give you a really cool translation of that? One, I kind of made it up this week. "Put your big boy pants on, Job." That's really what he's saying here. It's gird your loins up for action. Prepare yourself. I put in the margin, "Put on your big boy pants, Job, because you're going to need to come to grips with something. And you're going to need to come to grips with something pretty seriously." I will question you and you will make it known to me. God is saying to Job, Job, I'm going to ask the questions and you're going to answer them. In parentheses, sort of as those things that are between the lines, you're going to answer these questions if you can. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. So, where were you when I got this whole thing started that you say you can run better than me? Can we answer that? I'm not going to answer too quickly. Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Remember, this is Hebrew poetry. This is just dripping with power and with potency. So, where were you when I got this whole thing started? You really want to run this thing better than I could? Okay. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched out the line upon it? Or where were its bases sunk? That's the foundation pieces. Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea with its doors? He's referencing back to day three of creation, when it burst forth from the womb. When I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed limits for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far you shall come and no further. And here shall your proud waves be stayed. Have you commanded the morning since your days began? Job, have you been there to make the sun come up? Or have you been there at the end of the day to make the sun go down? And cause the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the skirt of the earth, and the wicked shall be shaken out of it? He goes on to describe creation and the fact, no, Job really wasn't there. Now, we need to start moving kind of quickly through the next couple of chapters. What God does with Job, he is actually starting over in verse 22, to say, Job, you remember this world that you think you can run so well? Number one, do you think you could create it in the first place? Number two, do you really think that you're all that qualified to maintain it and keep it running? And what he does, what God does, is he talks to Job, first of all, about the inanimate creation. Then he talks about the animate creation. So he says, in this one area, do you really think you can do a better job than I can? And in this other area, do you really think you can do a better job than I can? So we're going to walk through this. The first thing he does is he talks about storms. Chapter 38, verses 22 to 30. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Or have you seen the storehouses of the hail? No, we don't want to think about winter, so we're going to skip past that verse. Which I have reserved for a time of trouble, for the day of battle and war. What is the way to the place where the light is distributed, or where the east wind is scattered upon the earth? Who has cleft a channel for the torrents of rain? He's building all of these pictures of storms approaching, and saying, Job, do you have a handle on these things? Did you create them? Can you actually stop them? And he talks about the constellations. He goes from storms to stars, chapter 31, chapter 38, verses 31 to 33. Can you bind the chains of Pleiades? These are constellations. Or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth the Maseroth in their seasons? Or can you guide the bear with its children? So looking up at all the constellations, all of the stars, Job, can you really get a handle on these things? Can you really look up and say, okay, I want you to be over here. I want you to be over here. Can you actually place them there? Do you know the ordinances of the heaven? Can you establish their rule upon the earth? What he's doing, he's He's not trying to demoralize Job. He is trying to paint a big picture of who God is. Because as J.B. Phillips once said, your God is too small. He goes from storms to stars. Then he goes to clouds. 34 to 38. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that a flood of waters may cover you? Can you actually bring on the rain? Wouldn't you like to have a little button on the wall that you could do that with? Be kind of helpful for the farmers. How about this? Can you shut it off when it's rained too long? That ain't going to happen anytime soon. Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say, here we are. We are here to do your bidding. Can you actually do that? Again, he's not trying to demoralize Job. He's trying to show God, Job, how big his God really is. He moves from the inanimate creation, now he moves to the animate creation. And he starts out with two, the lion and the raven. Look at verses 39 to 41. Can you hunt prey for the lion or satisfy the appetites of the young lions? How many of you have ever been out walking in the Serengeti and a lion comes up to you? Says, Micah, I need some help. No, just sit down. But have you ever, would you ever be walking in the Serengeti? Would a lion ever come up and ask you that? No, he's probably going to chase you down and have you for lunch. Well, that's the picture. Or can you satisfy the appetites of the young lions when they crouch in their dens and lie in wait in the thicket? Here's a good question for you. Who provides for the raven? I know what you're thinking. Roadkill. Trucks, cars. Well, God does. I remember one time going up to Grand Bend. We went up early in the morning. We went and a group of buzzards, turkey buzzards, were having breakfast along the road. On the way back, there was hardly anything there. It's fascinating to watch. Yesterday I was watching. Day before yesterday, I saw a couple of them land in a field and was just watching them, realizing God provides for them. You see ravens along the road. You see them eating what most of us just continually run over. God provides for them. So, Job, you really think you can provide for the lions and the ravens? What about the mountain goats? What about the mountain goats? Do you know about their labor processes? Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the does? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Do you know the time when they're going to give birth? Really? Really, Job? Do you know this? I mean, can you, with pinpoint accuracy, tell us when Mr. and Mrs. Mountain Goat are going to have a baby goat? Probably not. What about the wild donkey? Who has let the wild donkey go free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift donkey? I mean, I'm sure you've all asked that question this morning. Only if you're driving in heavy traffic. Some of you get that. But really, who set him free? Do you know the way of the donkey? Really? Seriously? Donkeys are free-spirited. You could take that a lot of different ways, couldn't you? But they are. Especially wild donkeys, they're incredibly free-spirited. What about the wild oxen? Look at the wild oxen in verses 9 to 12. Is the wild oxen willing to serve you? Willing? I hardly think it. You really have to make them do it. That's what wild oxen are. They're wild. They're beasts that you're not going to keep with your little curly, fluffy puppy. Here we find out you're not even going to keep them with your cows because they're too nasty and they're unbroken. Can you bind him in a furrow with ropes? Can you actually go up to a massive beast like that? Say, come here, throw a little rope around it and tie it, walk it along with you. Do you think that's really going to happen anytime soon? The next one's my favorite. It's the ostriches. Francis Anderson writes in his commentary on Job, he says, from the sublime to the ridiculous, it is hard to argue that this hilarious sketch of the ostrich serves any solemn didactic purpose. Is it what it really is? It is what it really is, a silly bird, because God made it so. Why? This comical account suggests that amid the profusion of creatures, listen to this is great, some were made to be useful to men, but some were just for God's entertainment and ours. Don't you love ostriches? Well, look what it says about ostriches. The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are they the pinions of the plumage of love? Are they like a stork? That's what he says. For she lays her eggs to the earth. She leaves her eggs to the earth and lets them be warmed on the ground, forgetting that a foot may crush them. So these sort of senseless birds, lacking in wisdom, have been created by God too? And the answer is yes. She deals cruelly with her young, as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, yet she has no fear, because God has made her forget wisdom and has given her no share in understanding. When she rouses herself to flee, she laughs at the horse and at its rider. Do you know what some ostriches are clocked at running? 80 kilometers an hour. It goes faster than some of your pickup trucks. The ostrich. Can you really understand the way of the ostrich, Job? By the way, I made it. I made it that way. How about the horses? He goes on really to describe horses as valiant, as strong, mighty warriors. Have you seen horses in battle? Maybe not personally, but have you seen the horses from the Westerns? Have you seen the horses from World War I? Have you seen the horses from some of the more medieval warfare movies? How are they pictured? They're pictured almost as fearless. They're pictured as strong moving forward. That's how they are pictured here. They are majestic, snorting, and they move forward with power. Do you know why? God made them that way. Everything in this chapter is not meant to demoralize Job. It's meant to give Job a grander picture of who God really is. And then he talks about the hawks. Actually, the hawks and the eagles in verses 26 to 30. Is it by your understanding that the hawk soars? So, John, can you tell me all about the aerodynamics of a hawk? I mean, is it really by your ingenuity that the hawk flies and spreads its wings toward the south? Isn't it your command that the eagle mounts up? Really? How's that working for you? And then it makes its nest up on high. You know, I was at a Starbucks. You probably think, yeah, that's not a surprise. This is in Iowa, and we were on Brady Street. And across the street from Brady Street, there was one of those massive, massive power towers. And it was a big one. It was one of the big cement ones that you see in some of the big cities. And at the very top of that cement tower was an eagle's nest. You would not have caught me climbing up there. Yes, one day I would like to parachute, but I don't want to climb up to do it. And it was incredible. So do you really think you could program the eagles or the hawks to set their nests on high? Do you really think you can tell them how to fly? Do you really think you can teach them all of the laws of aerodynamics? On the rock he dwells and makes his home, on a rocky crag and stronghold. From there he spies out his prey, his eyes behold it from afar. Have you ever seen a hawk in some of our fields around here? Just circling slowly. You've probably all seen it. They're just circling slowly, real slow. And then they seem to slow down. And then they seem to slow down even more. And then you know what happens? Bam! Straight down to the ground, and they've landed on a toy poodle or something like that, or a cat, probably a mouse or a rabbit. They know when to do it. God's word is intended to overwhelm Job with majesty and with mystery. Not with the majesty and mystery of the answers that he was looking for. Majesty and mystery don't always bring answers. Job was looking for answers. God really didn't give him answers. God's word wanted to overwhelm Job with the majesty and the mystery of the God who sovereignly rules the world, and intended to correct some of Job's misguided understandings about who it is that really runs this place. Sometimes we all need to be brought to that place, don't we? Yeah, I could probably do a better job than you, Lord. No, we wouldn't say that out loud. But by the way we live, by the way we act, by the way we behave, we think, yeah, you know, I can do the things a whole lot better than he can because I take things into my own hands. I take matters into my own hands. And instead of following his plan and principle for doing things, I do them however I jolly well want. So how does Job respond? Really? How does Job respond? Let's look at some of Job's responses and ours, maybe, if they're ours. Okay? Here's his first response. Humility. Chapter 40. The Lord said to Job, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty?" By the way, you know who he's calling a fault finder? Help me, we'll get done quicker. He's calling Job a fault finder. He is referring to Job as a fault finder, or one who reproves. You really want to reprove me, Job? Do you really want to correct me? One of the trainers at our gym was chatting with me one morning and was just saying, I was just asking about all the different people that come here, and I asked about who it is that they struggle with the most. And he said, and she said this, trainers from other gyms. Because they come in wanting to teach you something. Or someone that maybe has gone to a certain level, they want to come in and they want to teach you something. That's kind of where Job was. He really kind of wanted to teach God something, and God said, "No, I don't think you're going to reprove me." By the way, interestingly enough, if you look back at chapter 38, verse 1, "Then the Lord answered Job." Chapter 40, verse 1, "And the Lord said to Job." Anything significant about the word Lord? It's the divine name of God. It is the name Yahweh. We see that when we have all capitals. It is his covenant name. We haven't seen that since chapter 2. It's pretty significant. It sort of explodes now on this page. The Lord said to Job, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty?" By the way, if you're going to refer to the Lord as Almighty, it's probably not a good idea to reprove him. It's probably not a good idea to contend with him. And he argues with God, let him answer it. Job's first response, behold, I am of small account. It's an attitude of humility. I think the NIV has unworthy. Anybody have an NIV out there? Unworthy. Christian Standard Bible has an insignificant, or so insignificant. Anybody else have a different way that's translated?
Vile.
What are you reading, John? Oh, okay, you got a commentary. Awesome, awesome. All right, we'll do point here, we'll do counterpoint afterwards over there. That's great, that's awesome. But vile, does the New American Standard have that? A different translation for that? I'm just looking for people to talk, just to remind me that we're weak. Here's the idea. It's I'm down here. I'm at a place kind of like kneeling. It's the place that modern psychology would tell you not to go to. It's a place that modern psychology says, no. You can't make that kind of assessment. But did you notice something? God doesn't reprove Job for these words. Job has been brought to a place of humility. The word translated insignificant or of small account, I actually love the translation. It means to be light in weight. You know what Job's saying? I'm just a lightweight. I don't carry any weight here. In comparison to God, we are all lightweights. We go to God and we pray. We go to God and we ask, sometimes strongly. Paul, 3 times, 2 Corinthians 12, begged God for the removal of the thorn. The Lord Jesus prayed, Lord, if there's any other way, remove this cup from me. And yet in humility, not my will but yours be done. That was Job's first response. He recognized, I'm a lightweight here. I am a complete lightweight. Second response of Job. And you might not see it, but it's a response of relief. Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? By the way, that's a rhetorical question in case you missed it. Okay? Have you ever been in a situation with a child? And you've gotten really exasperated at the child. And you said something to the effect of, do I look stupid to you? And the kid's actually thinking of an answer. All right? They have not yet grasped the concept of the rhetorical question. What do I look like? Give me some thought on that one. This is Job's rhetorical question. How in the world can I possibly answer this? That's an expression of relief. Because Job realized God wasn't looking for answers from Job. God had all the answers. And Job acknowledged that fact. He came to a place when he came to an end of himself. God, I don't have the answers. Implied, I know you do, but I'm okay that I don't have them. On my desk, I have a lot of things on my desk. Pray for me. I have little squishy toys on my desk. And one of the squishy toys on my desk is a picture of a guy. Well, it's not a picture, it's a little squishy toy of a guy whose legs are twisted up around his head, and his arms are all twisted in like this. And it's one of those little squishy things, the stress-relieving things. And I got it at a pastor's conference. And printed across the front of it says, he defines relief, and it's this: breathe. You're not in charge. So as you're sitting there squishing it, you're realizing, yeah, I'm not really in charge of much of anything. That's where Job landed. And for him, it was a sense of relief. When we realize that, no, really, I'm not in charge of much of anything. Now, I can't do much with the ostrich. I can't make the ostrich a whole lot smarter. I can't make the lion a whole lot more of an efficient killer. And whatever donkeys do, I can probably only add to their confusion. There was a sense of relief with Job. Number three, there was a surrender with Job. Behold, I'm a lightweight. And in that second line, you almost have a, I don't have to answer. And number three, I lay my hand on my mouth. I'm going to stop talking. I was expecting applause. I've said enough. That's what Job's saying. I've said enough. Maybe I've said too much. I will stop talking now. I will trust. That's really what Job's getting at here. I have laid my hand upon my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer twice. I will proceed no further. If you were in the U.S. South, you would hear this expression. Well, shut my mouth. It's kind of where Job is. But it's not a shutting of a mouth because of just utter frustration. No, this is surrender. This is, God, I'm going to trust you. I'm going to utterly trust you in the midst of this. In the midst of his storm. It's still swirling. He's still there. And he surrenders. All right, we're going to close with three principles. Three principles from really for us in 2018. By the way, if you write these down and don't look at them until next year, you can scratch out the 8 and put a 9 in there. They're still applicable. Principle number one. Since God's ways are higher than my ways, then whatever he allows, I bow before him in submission. That's humility. That's Job in humility, recognizing the principle of Isaiah 55, 8 and 9. God says, my ways are higher than your ways. My thoughts are higher than your thoughts. We can't really get to them. We can't comprehend them. We can't understand them. And it's as though Job is just saying, okay, I'm a lightweight in this. I am going to bow in submission to whatever you allow in my life. And bluntly, it might suck right now. But I am going to bow in submission to it. Number two. Since God is in full control, then however he directs my steps, I will follow in obedience. Since God is in full control, he's in control of the, remember the storms and the stars and the clouds and the donkeys and the ostriches and the war horses and name it, just keep going on and on and on. But what does that imply? That he's not only in control of his inanimate creation, he's also in control of his animate creation. Point just one finger at who that includes. Since God is in full control, then however he directs my steps, I will follow in obedience. I will seek to hear his voice. I will seek to understand his will. And I will follow him in obedience. By the way, obedience is not legalism. Legalism is legalism. Obedience is obedience. Just thought I'd add that. Number three. Since God has the answers that I lack, doesn't he? Wouldn't you say he does? He knows everything. He's not, as some would say, that God is sort of working through things and kind of not knowing what's going on until they actually happen. That's lame. Since God has the answers I lack, even though he may not give us all the answers, whenever he does speak, I need to listen in silence. I need to listen in silence and surrender. We really need to be like Samuel in 1 Samuel. That whenever God speaks in his word, through a proclaimed message, through some book you are reading and God is speaking to you, whenever God speaks, we need to listen with the attitude of little Samuel in 1 Samuel. You remember what it is? Speak, Lord, or your servant is listening. And then you know what we need to do? The ash heap may be an appropriate place on which to sit if we are in mourning. But it is no place to stay if we wish to get better. Sometimes we will most help distressed people, help them draw nearer to God from the depths of depression, not by teaching them doctrine or by preaching our best sermon or by showing them the error of their ways, but by walking with them around the garden, taking them to see a waterfall or a sunset, by helping them recover an enjoyment of the created world. Such steps are not always practicable, of course, but insofar as we can enable, listen to this, depressed people to see themselves in a new setting and to recover a place of security and belonging within the rich panorama of God's creation, we are helping them immensely. So point ourselves to a massive God, to a massive sovereign God who cares for us more than we can ever possibly imagine. Lord, today, Help us to see God for who he is. In the midst of what we're dealing with, whatever it is, help us to see God for who he really is.